Hi, everyone. I'm Raj Kumar, President and Editor-in-Chief of DevEx. This week, we'll be breaking down the big headlines in global development and bringing in some top experts to help us do it. If you want to follow along with the stories we're talking about, check out devx.com and subscribe to our daily newsletter, The Newswire. There's a link in the description. Follow us along on Twitter, and you can see many of the stories we're talking about today. And we'd love to hear what you think. This is This Week in Global Development.
We've got with us a couple of returning guests, my colleague Edva Saldinger. Hey, Edva.
Hi, Raj. Great to be back with you.
Yeah, nice to hear your voice. Edva is, of course, a senior reporter here at DevEx and covers, based here in DC with me, and covers lots of things related to development finance. And we're joined once again by Nasra Ismail. Hi, Nasra.
Hi, Raj. Hi, Edva. It's so good to be here with you guys again. Thanks for the invite.
Yeah, great to be with you too. And Nasra is the U.S. Executive Director at Alight. And well, you hold lots of other hats too. You sit on the boards of Verasso and Refuge Point, and you've got a long career across philanthropy and government and NGO work and humanitarian space and the development space. So always great to get your insights, Nasra. And I know a lot of times that you're on with us, we're talking about localization, and this week is no exception. In fact, DevEx has launched a whole new series all about localization that we're thrilled to talk about. And we actually have a piece that helps to kick that series off. The series is called Roots of Change. And we have a piece by our own David Ainsworth all about five things we learned on localization. Or maybe we could have titled it Things We Haven't Learned About Localization, because a lot of it is, you know, where we still have a lack of definition, a lack of consensus. This, I'm curious about your take on his piece and just generally on where you think we are on this, since it's an issue you follow so closely.
Yeah, no, thank you, Raj. I think we continue to learn. I mean, I think that's the biggest message in just this one piece of all of our global development oriented policy reforms. Reforms take a very long time. Reforms, as we all know, are debated heavily over a long gradual process. So I'm actually of the opinion, and I'm very, you know, optimistic about this. I've been following localization for the last, you know, 10 years. And I think the fact that it stayed up front as a topic of discussion and debate is really good. I think we find ourselves, at least as someone like me who counts my efforts towards the alliance of local actors being based in the Global South for half of my career, I think we have so much to owe to media houses like yours, like DevEx, who've kept it on top of mind. And I think that's important. We don't mind the debate. I think it's welcomed. It's asking a lot of organizations and agencies like USAID. So I think, you know, David did a great job of pointing out at least five principled lessons learned, but there could be many, I'm sure. So I think for me, it's I'm just surprised, Raj, that it's lasted this long. I thought we'd shelf this and go and move on to something new and exciting and trendy, but I'm actually quite optimistic about the way they stayed.
I'm glad you're optimistic. I talk to probably just as many people who are pessimistic. You know, if there's one thing about people who work in global development, there's a lot of opinions, and it keeps our work busy. And I guess a lot of people still look at this and say it is a little bit of a fad. It is kind of nibbling around the edges, and the core work of development sort of continues to go on the way it long has. But you're right. It's, you know, we certainly report about it a lot because it's a topic of great debate. It's both a topic of business debate, right? It's fundamentally important to NGOs, for example, in terms of, you know, how will they get funded and how will they be structured. But it's also important to people who just care about whether development gets done and gets done right. And so, you know, for a lot of people, this is not just a question of sort of, you know, the structures and the accounting and the legalities, but it's a question of whether these development efforts that this whole community is engaged in actually work or not. Edva, you, of course, hear a lot about this topic in your coverage. I'd love to get your take on where we are with it.
Yeah, you know, I think the first point that David points out, that it's not just about shifting the funding, it's about shifting the power, is something that I hear a lot about, right? The system is designed in a way that makes that sometimes more difficult. And part of that is structures and the way that these institutions are built. But one of the things that I hear about, and not just in the sort of grant funding space, but also in the private sector space, is the idea that communities don't want to be dictated to about what is going to fix their problems or what is going to address their priorities. I think in the sort of development finance private sector space, sometimes I've heard from communities who feel like they're being told, well, to improve, you know, economic development, you need, you know, we're going to invest in some boats to improve trade down your river. But the community actually didn't want that. And there are, I think, some interesting experiments where it's about communities identifying their priorities and then sticking to that. I was speaking to someone who works, local civil society organization works with communities in West Africa, who was talking about, you know, at the real village level, setting priorities. And then if people came in and wanted to invest even significant sums of money, they said, well, do you see this is our list of priorities as a community? And so, no, we don't want to do that. And so I think that that's a piece of this that I'm really glad we highlighted in this piece, because I think for a while, the focus was so much on how do you shift the funding that it was less about shifting the power and who's deciding exactly how these programs are going to be focused or carried out.
Yeah, you're making me think, Advatu, that there is a little bit of a disconnect in the sense that people who are talking about localization, even using that language, they tend to be in the grant funding or the bilateral contracting space, right? It is the USAIDs and the FCDOs. And I feel like the conversation that's happening in the development finance space is a bit different. And there it's all about crowding in the private sector. And, you know, in a minute we can talk about the IDB and what's happening over there at IDB Invest. But it does feel like that's a different discussion, because in some ways, if it's a private sector led initiative, in order to work, it has to have local buy-in, because it will literally have local buyers, you know, whether it's government that's purchasing power from a power plant or and consumers that are purchasing that power, you know, whatever it is that you're investing in as a investor seeking a return, it's got to be localized in a way. And maybe that's why the language is not used in the same sense in the DFI community. I don't know if either of you have a perspective on that.
Yeah, maybe I can just chime in here. I mean, I think no matter what, the thing we all come back to is, you know, point number three from David's work, which is to talk about localization, it's a lot easier to be serious about it and to do something about it and to shape your organizations and your models around it. So I think that is very sobering for all of us to arrive at. I remember, Raj, in the beginning, several years ago, we were talking about why does this definition seem so hard? Why are we all focused on definition? And then I think the sway of the debate was, well, listen, if you can just solve the money problem, then we'll all be okay. But with the money then comes just a whole heck of a lot of diverse actors who all identify as local, who all have some bite of the definition of whether it means to have an office in the global south, whether it means you can do work outside of your country, whether it means you can have leadership and boards that represent a significant amount of the people that are on the recipient end. So I think that part continues, and we're kind of going around a merry-go-round of localization. But I think the fact that it is hard to practice is a well-earned and wise lesson for all of us. I was just at the African Diaspora Forum in San Jose just a couple of weeks ago, where I sat next to the assistant administrator, for Africa Bureau at USAID. And I just asked her, I said, Dr. Mondi, like, where do you find success in this? Because I know, exactly as you said, different people find different parts of it successful and different areas difficult to move. But I was really surprised and felt very good about what she said. She said, you know, if you look at the FAR and ADAR rules, these are the governing procurement, acquisition, how money flows, how processes are done at USAID. If you look at those requirements, it is going to be difficult for an agency like us to move the needle. But we're very happy to have secured philanthropic funding to be able to de-risk some of our risky investments. So I think that is a great maneuver. That is a lesson for other agencies outside of the US. That is something to celebrate, because if we're serious about the full spectrum of localization, voice, vision, strategy, representation, ultimately changing the model of 80, 90 years of what we've learned to be a norm in the development sector, it is going to take twice as much time to get it right. So I'm hoping for everyone to be patient. And I like number five from David's article. It's difficult. I do want to plug maybe one thing, which is a different article that came out at DevEx. And I was really, really happy about this. This was written by the co-executive directors of the African Visionary Fund, and they talk about this collaborative work they've done over the last few years to talk about the 8 principles of making this equity principles and metrics framework work for localization. And I hope people really pay attention to that, because I found that extremely helpful for folks who are looking for indicators and metrics of success and getting this right beyond money.
Yeah, I'm glad you called that out. And in fact, the African Visionary Fund is one of our partners on this Roots of Change content series that we've just launched, which has tons of great content if you're interested in what's going on in the localization space. We've got about a dozen partners, from them to the Mayor's Migration Council to Action Against Hunger and many, many more. And we're producing lots of really interesting reporting on exactly what is happening on the front lines of localization. So take a look at that if you're interested.
Are you looking for the inside story on what's happening at organizations like the World Bank, USAID, or the Gates Foundation? Then you need to be reading DevEx Pro. I'm Jessica Abrahams, and I'm the editor of DevEx Pro. Pro is DevEx's premium news subscription, where our expert reporters and analysts take you beyond the headlines, deep into the trends and institutions shaping the $200 billion aid industry. As well as all our news, you'll get access to conversations with global development leaders, resources to help you grow in your career, and a subscriber-only newsletter full of insider news and tidbits. See for yourself by getting a free trial today at devx.com/pro.
Maybe, Yvonne, we can shift gears a little bit into what's happening at the Inter-American Development Bank. You had a really important piece this week all about their reforms.
Yeah, I did want to, on localization, just flag one thing that we covered in the last couple weeks, which is that there was a bipartisan bill in Congress that passed the House Foreign Affairs Committee that would make some changes to USAID contracting requirements. For example, allowing USAID to accept grant applications in languages other than English, or giving local entities like more time extensions to meet the reporting requirements. And I think that could help ease the way and reduce some of the current constraints at USAID. So I just wanted to mention that, because I think that is a piece of that localization conversation for USAID that could push things forward. On IDB and IDB Invest, in early March at their annual meeting, several things happened for the IDB group as a whole. A new strategy was approved, and new funding for both IDB Invest, which is its private sector arm, and IDB Lab, which is its sort of venture innovation arm, both got more capital. And the amount of capital that IDB Invest got, $3.5 billion, will roughly double the amount of capital that that institution has. And I sat down with Ilan Goldfein, the president of IDB, and with the CEO of IDB Invest, James Scriven, last week to really talk through, you know, now they've been working for years to get this capital increase for IDB Invest and on this new sort of direction and strategy over the last year for the organization as a whole. So really looking at what's next. And I think the things that stand out are, organizationally, they're really looking to enact a culture change and a shift in focus for the institution as a whole to be much more directed at impact. So that means that they're actually looking at, with their HR departments, how do we create incentive structures where people aren't incentivized on the number of deals or the dollar value of deals that they're doing, but on the impact of their work. And creating incentives around not only when people do successful projects, but when people flag when projects aren't going right, so that they can be sort of corrected midstream. So I think as a whole, that's quite an interesting piece. And for IDB Invest, what their real goal is private sector mobilization, and sort of looking at a new model where they are going to be structuring deals. So they're going to play a key role in sort of bringing together partners, but they're going to put a much smaller percentage of their own money into the deal and try to get much more private sector into these transactions.
Yeah, you know what I find interesting, Advaz, of course, Ajay Banga has taken on a lot of the attention for this broader movement around reforming the multilateral development banks, and for good reason. The World Bank is the biggest, it's the flagship of all the MDBs. But in some ways, what's happening at the IDB, you know, there might be a bit of a foot race here to see who's going to reform faster. It is surprising in this moment when it is so tough to secure new pledges from donors that the IDB has been successful, relatively successful in a capital increase and increasing its investments for IDB Invest. I mean, that's a big deal to have in 2023 in this election year, and 2024 in this election year when so many other agencies are looking for replenishments and there's a real battle for funding. And a lot of these moves that you describe, they are precisely what the World Bank is aiming to do. You know, the idea that IDB Invest would become more like a deal maker, creating opportunities, getting them going, putting in some of the seed capital, but then selling off some of its stake to other investors, bringing in more private sector. So the IDB would have, you know, more dry powder to go out and invest in the next potential deal. That's a pretty big change in their operating model and in as you say, in their culture.
Partly because IDB is smaller than the World Bank, it can be more nimble. And when I talk to folks in the private sector, investors, asset managers, and the like, they are, in general, quite impressed with what IDB Invest is doing. They see IDB Invest as far more innovative than IFC, for example. And I was talking to someone just recently who said that part of that is because actually for years, IDB Invest has been quite capital constrained. And so they've had to be innovative and creative with how they use their money. And that obviously there's a leadership decision there to change the way things work. I mean, I think it'll be really interesting to see now with this capital increase what happens. I think one of the things you mentioned is that the World Bank and IFC, they talk about like an originate to sell model, or they might structure a deal and then sell it and get out of it. IDB Invest talks about it a little bit differently because they actually plan to stay in most of the transactions over the long term, but just put a much smaller amount in up front. And I think I can give you an example, which might help people sort of understand that. Last year, they structured a $368 million loan to a renewable energy company in the Dominican Republic to build three new renewable energy projects and refinance some debt on other projects. And so IDB structured the deal, but they only put $37 million of that $368 million loan in from their own funds, and the remaining contributions came from 21 other financial institutions. That is like a 10-to-1 mobilization ratio, which is much, much higher than the mobilization rates of most other DFIs. And that's partly because the Dominican Republic is a market that has a better credit rating. And so they also, you know, said, like, you know, in places like the Dominican Republic or Costa Rica with good credit ratings, like that mobilization rate should be really high. But in places like Haiti, it might be zero because of the market environment. And so overall, they want sort of a 2-to-1 mobilization ratio. But in those countries with better credit ratings, they really want to sort of push on that and have a much greater mobilization ratio.
Yeah, it is interesting how the IDB's region, Latin America and the Caribbean, has so much diversity on exactly, you know, the point you mentioned about credit ratings, but also just the status of so many countries. Some are growing, innovative, stable, and secure, and then you've got others. Haiti is an example, Venezuela is another, Ecuador currently with all the criminal activity there. There's, and of course, Central America, you know, it's a very mixed bag, and we have both, you know, very large, modern, advanced economies and really significant humanitarian crises happening at the same time in the same region.
I would even just say, and that's been really, really super helpful just to hear exactly these, not only voices that we're hearing and you're reporting on, but also I think, you know, after 2020, I think maybe we're seeing some delayed need to look internal. Many organizations, whether you're philanthropic, whether you're more multilateral banks, or even just nonprofit, the need to look inside and question. And I really interested by the fact that at least some of the reform here with the Inter-American Development Bank has been, we want our people to care about our impact, to care more about how we are structured. And so I think that internal look is also just recognizing the need that we've had so many changes in our world over the last 4 years, even if you don't look at the last 10 or 20. And so the need to look and centralize culture and HR and workforce. And then on top of that, Roger, what you're saying, the context for some of these regions have changed so much just in the last year and a half. And so a need to see how models are responding, how models are staying fit for the future, but also welcoming more people and playing an ecosystem actor rather than doing things alone or even just from their own business strategy. I think that is wholehearted change management that we've all been wanting and desiring. I'm here for all of that. Actually, I think it's time. It's time to see other banks try something new, fail even if they have to, but welcome others into a space and enjoy the messy middle.
Yeah, I think these institutional culture questions are really fascinating, right? Like you think about, I'm about to do an interview with Nisha Biswal, who's the deputy CEO over at the DFC, the Development Finance Corporation. And for an institution like that, for a long time, the way you might determine whether you're doing a good job or not, if you work there, is did I make an investment? Did I make a commitment to invest in some deal? And if you work at the World Bank, it might be, did I make a loan? And how big was that loan? If you work at USAID, it might be, did this project move forward? And what was the scale of that project? And it's totally natural for organizations to have these kind of units of activity that they measure themselves against. And they often would look at the things that are easiest to measure as a sign of whether they're doing their job or not. And I think we are in a moment now, as you say, Nasra, maybe it's a post-2020 thing where people are asking themselves, well, are those the right units of activity? Is that what we should be measuring ourselves against? Or is it something more about impact? And how do we do a better job figuring out what that impact is so we can measure that and make that our culture? Because it might actually sometimes be at cross purposes. Maybe if you're at USAID, doing that one really big project isn't as impactful as a bunch of small ones to local actors. And how do you kind of get into an internal institutional culture that values those smaller but more impactful things? I don't know if you have a thought about this, but I'm also interested to hear your take on this piece that our colleague Miguel Antonio Tamonan wrote about how USAID plans to spend its $25 billion in the next coming months.
Yeah, I was just going to say on your last point, on private capital, that's like maybe even more important, because in the lowest income countries, you're probably not going to get massive deals, right? Like there's not companies of that scale. The markets maybe can't absorb that much capital all at once. And so actually, if you're incentivized to do large deals or get lots of money out the door, it can actually push an organization to do more in middle income markets than in low income countries. And so I think that's important. I think one other piece on that front is just, it's also about risk appetite and perspective around risk. Because I think if they're really focused on impact, these organizations also will have to be willing to take more risk. In many ways, they're quite risk averse still. And it was interesting to me that James Scriven, who obviously leads one of these organizations, was like, the risk appetite of all the multilaterals and development finance institutions that you see, they look like commercial banks. And I think that there's a lot of people in the development community that would argue that because these are publicly funded development institutions, the risk appetite frameworks, the balance sheets should look pretty different. And to your point about USAID spending in that article, I mean, I just really encourage people to go and look at it, because there's also just a really interesting interactive tableau where you can dive into the data a bit further. And I think one thing that won't surprise people is that some of the biggest contracts that are still out there are tied to global health. That's sort of the sector where there's a lot in the contract. And then part of that is we've done a ton of reporting on this series of next gen contracts, which is USAID's flagship program in global health supply chain. There's been a lot of controversy over it. And so a series of contracts that are tied to next gen are part of this forecast. And some of those have been pushed out even farther, like another year. So we keep seeing delays in those contracts. And I'm sure we will continue to follow and bring you the story on that, as my colleagues have been tracking over the years. And then, I mean, I think one of the things that was also interesting to me in that was sort of looking at U.S. missions and where sort of funding among the missions will be spent. And it looked like the biggest sum is going to be spent in Central Asia in terms of the forecast today. And then the Senegal, Zambia, and Nigeria missions also are looking to spend quite a bit of money.
Yeah, I echo your point there that it's really worth diving in. It's not, there isn't necessarily one big theme that comes out to me, but it's just always fascinating to see where the money is going and what it's being spent on. Nisra, did you get a chance to see that piece too?
I did, and I really welcomed just having more and more numbers and more priorities for that, you know, we can all connect to. I think it's important once you get to these large contracts, these large sort of health system reforms, I think, you know, it can get a little overwhelming. So I think just putting all of that language in plain language, putting all those reforms in plain language is super helpful. I know the one thing that I appreciated from that article was just the, you know, the fact that a lot of this is risk-based. I think last I was talking to a couple of colleagues and former contractors at USAID, the biggest driver of success for all of us in localization, new models of working, being more inclusive, was down to the risk appetite statements. I think January was the last time USAID reviewed and maybe updated its risk appetite statement. And I think that deserves way more attention, that deserves way more discussion, because it's those fears around who's risky, where do the risks come from, where do we have non-financial related and reputational risk in places where conflict is active, in places where aggressive government structural shutdown of civic spaces, democratic spaces is really, really restricted. I think that's where we need to have discussions around localization, where local actors are best placed, where local investment is best placed. And in discussion, at least with East and Western Africa, where food sovereignty is critical to that continent's progress into some of the bigger agenda items that's in front of the African Union, I think these conversations are really, really necessary. So it's less about the contracts and more about investing in systems at the local level, at the continental level.
Yeah, I think you and Bob both make a great point, just as we start to wrap up here, you know, about this issue of risk. And it, when I look at the interactive graphic here on how USAID plans to spend its money, it looks kind of complex. And then you think, well, in some ways this is complex, but actually it's simplified compared to what USAID is dealing with in terms of their own funding picture. It's not as though they can just choose what to fund. Everything is heavily earmarked by Congress. You know, money is put into very specific buckets and specific geographies. It has to meet multiple different purposes and demands. There's huge compliance and oversight. So this is just a highly complex picture because of the nature of global development spending coming from taxpayers, and it's really the case everywhere in the world. Maybe there's varying levels of complexity, but it's there pretty much everywhere in the global north. And I guess historically that oversight, that approach, the politics of aid has led to this fear about risk. And it does seem like maybe we're now at a tipping point with your coverage of, the US Congress's push for more innovation and localization, with that same trend taking hold in other parts of the world, that maybe now donor governments are saying, actually, the bigger risk is allowing situations like what's happening in Haiti. It's, you know, allowing countries to become effectively failed states, or to have reduced economic growth, or to have food insecurity. Like, maybe that's the bigger issue, the bigger risk. And we do need these institutions, whether it's the IDB or USAID or others, to actually take on more risk. And they're getting that message from their funders, from their elected officials. And that, if it's true, if that's more than just a blip, would be a really big sea change, I think, for this space.
I would just chime in and say that, you know, things at USAID are not only constrained by the sort of typical earmarks that Congress puts in place, but also because there was a funding cut this year. I've heard from some people that it may be actually really difficult with the resources available to meet all of those earmarks. And one of the things, you know, I've written a lot about how dysfunctional the whole budget process has been this year to get to this 2024 budget. But even once that budget's approved, there's a whole secondary approval process that USAID has to go through to get Congress to sign off on how they're allocating the funding. And so there's really going to be a time crunch at the end of this year to get money out the door. And what people tell me is that that means sometimes things aren't as effective or efficient as they could be. And so I do think that's one piece of this to keep an eye on moving forward.
Yeah, and rushing the money typically helps the larger global north-based institutions that know how the system works and that have the ability to absorb that funding very quickly.
Absolutely. I mean, I think to me, this is such a healthy start. I feel like, Adva, you're saying it might be messy, it might be not the most effective way, but I think that change is welcome. I think we need to think beyond what we were been doing last 20, 30, 40, 50 years. So I welcome USAID digging deep into its cultural beliefs and psychological associations around fear. Who's risky and who's not? Climate is the greatest risk that we have. We've got wars that are happening almost every part of the world. That is the greatest risk that we have. We've got to have models that respond in a new way, in ways that we're partnering with others, in ways we're not just digging into the same fund, but we're inviting more people to come in and co-create with us. I think there's times where we have to get into the messy middle, change some of the parameters. And I'm actually seeing USAID step into a space where it's able to be quite vulnerable and be open to criticism and be able to respond to some of those criticism and see what it's able to do. The fact that it's brought in Skoll Philanthropy and the Hilton Foundation as ways to leverage the existing deficient, funding pipeline that it has means that they're trying. They're trying to do something to meet the goals that are needed in order for the world to be better, for democracy to take root almost everywhere, but then also to realize they have their own limitations. We hope more and more agencies like USAID, as bureaucratic as USAID can be, can really open themselves up to doing things in a new way. And it'll take time. It's back to what David said. Localization is easier to talk about than actually put in practice.
Well, as usual, there's far more news to talk about than we have time to talk about, but it's been great to be with both of you and to cover at least some of the big stories that are happening this week. Nesra Ismail, Adva Salvinger, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Raj. Thank you, Adva.
Thank you, Raj. Thanks, Nesra.
This has been This Week in Global Development. If you enjoyed this episode, don't forget to subscribe using the link in the description. To get even more coverage and analysis on the most pressing development issues of the day, become a DevEx Pro member by going to devx.com/membership and signing up. Thank you for listening, and see you next week.